Welcome to the townhall.com weekend journal brought to you by the Salem Radio Network. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Afghanistan is back in the news, this time leaving the U.S. to mourn the murder of Army Major General Green. Does this sound a death knell to the progress in this sad place?
Everyone tightens down enormously. There's more tension. There's more suspicion. There's less work accomplished. All those things follow. So this was a bad blow.
Meanwhile, we are watching the effects of confusion and paralysis in U.S. foreign policy. Disloyalty to our friends has allowed Iraq to continue its descent into darkness, and recent bombings there do not promise a quick turnaround.
It's not unbelievable to think that we may not support the Kurds. I want to cry. It's such a dark period, the Obama administration.
The elite media continues its confused, biased fixation on indicting Israel for defending itself against a determined, deceitful death cult.
The remarkable thing is that Israel is acting the way that we're acting when our home front is under attack.
Plus, would the U.S. defend a fellow NATO nation?
I think any NATO country would be crazy to believe that Obama will honor those treaties.
God knows.
His policy is to honor nothing.
All this and more coming up on the townhall.com weekend journal. Thank you for joining us. Our efforts in Afghanistan suffered a setback last week as a shooter wearing an Afghan Army uniform machine-gunned a group of Western military officials, killing among them U.S. Major General Harold J. Green. The initial response from the Pentagon is that this tragedy, which also wounded a German brigadier general and an Afghan general in charge of the officer school where the shooting took place, will not impact the U.S.'s plans to draw its troops down by year's end. General Green was the highest-ranking military officer killed since the 9/11 terrorist attack. He was 55 years old and from a distinguished military family. His son, Lieutenant Matthew Green, a West Point grad, described his father as, quote, loving, charismatic, and full of energy. My Salem colleague Bill Bennett brought in author and combat veteran Bing West to discuss the implications of this tragedy.
Bing, we lost a general. I know we grieve for every soldier. Getting a general is a big prize for the bad guys, isn't it?
It certainly is. It illustrates to me one thing, and that is the degree of treachery that exists inside the Afghan ranks. The Afghan interpreters and the Afghan lieutenants, when I would ask them, they'd be talking to somebody and say, do you know who is a Taliban? They would say, no, they lie too good. So this again illustrates that they can't trust people in their own ranks.
Yeah. And tell us what you know about the facts. This was a guy in Afghan military uniform, right? Afghan soldier uniform.
Correct, and it was at this officers' academy that the British run. So it's like being at West Point and having this happen. It isn't just somebody who is a casual person. This is a person who had been inside the military for 2 years before this occurred, and there was no warning that it was going to occur. On the other hand, there has to be grave reservations about how casual we have become, because 15 persons were struck down.
Yeah,
15. That's a lot. And that causes me to think that there was many people were too relaxed.
Yeah, no, I know. We had a report of 17, but 15, 17 doesn't matter. Wouldn't a general have security around him?
Yes. Yes, that's what I mean. That in a war zone, at a British academy, something went very wrong on the security side as well. And you can anticipate now what's happened. Everyone tightens down enormously. There's more tension. There's more suspicion. There's less work accomplished. All those things follow. So this was a bad blow.
Now, if you're talking about, let me lead in with a general question, then we'll get more specific, Bing. Is this emblematic of what we got going on in Afghanistan and Iraq and elsewhere? Is this a kind of sign symptomatic of American defeat because of American policy? I don't mean the end of time or the end of America, but is this just another sad indicator of where we are?
Partially, yes. Also, partially, it's an indication that when certain movements, this is a religious movement, in history get going, they gather some momentum for a while until they play themselves out. So even abstracting from America inside the mix, what you have is those who are most motivated, and they're motivated by a very zealous strain of Islam, and our administration refuses to admit that even exists.
Yeah, sure, that it's there, that failure to name, call things by their proper names, right?
Not far away, another tragedy is unfolding. The Sunni-dominant ISIS militants, now simply Islamic State, continues to move forward, ravaging cities in northern Iraq, creating humanitarian crisis and triggering bombing by the United States. The geocultural regions of Kurdistan could be next in line for the murdering Islamist hordes. The tragic thing is the dissolution of the nation of Iraq was unnecessary, as my colleague Dennis Prager recently pointed out on his show.
Another day, another Middle Eastern defeat, writes the Wall Street Journal in a piece titled Abandoning the Kurds. On Sunday, the Islamic State in Iraq and al-Sham, or ISIS, ousted Kurdish forces from three towns in northern Iraq and laid siege to the country's largest dam. The question now is whether the Obama administration will abandon our longtime Kurdish allies as they battle the jihadist army. It's not unbelievable to think that we may not support the Kurds. I want to cry. It's such a dark period, the Obama administration. It's so dark for the world. Evil has been told you won't be opposed. It's the first time in my life as an American, basically. Whew. Earlier this summer, ISIS routed the Iraqi army in Mosul, and its success against the Kurdish Peshmerga militia, that's what it's known as, is another ominous turn. Kurdistan has been an island of relative peace and prosperity in Iraq that was thought to be beyond the Islamist reach. But ISIS is gaining strength the longer it is unchallenged. And the oil city of Kirkuk that is defended by the Peshmerga is a tempting future target. An Islamist caliphate with oil revenues is a scary prospect. And I don't get scared easily, and I agree with the Wall Street Journal. Since President Obama withdrew all U.S. forces in 2011, the U.S. has provided more than $1 billion a year in military aid and sold $10 billion in hardware to Baghdad. But the Kurds have seen little of it. The Baghdad government has also denied the Kurds their share of oil revenues, so the Kurds have sought to export oil themselves, which the U.S. has tried to block. You hear that? It's like John Kerry going to the Middle East and saying, Israel has a right to defend itself, but I'm here to stop the war in the very beginning, and I will ally myself with the two biggest haters of Israel, Turkey and Qatar, against Israel, against Egypt, against Jordan, against Saudi Arabia. It's inverted, it's morally inverted, our foreign policy. I didn't know this. Did you know this? The U.S. tried to block oil revenues from Kurdistan. Isn't that unbelievable? As ISIS charged toward Baghdad, Kurdish leaders last month sent a delegation to Washington to seek military assistance. What do you think the next line is, folks? I'll read you the line again. As ISIS charged toward Baghdad, Kurdish leaders last month sent a delegation to Washington to seek military assistance. Ready? Obama administration officials brushed them off. How many Americans know this?
For weeks, Israel supporters worldwide have been aghast at Western media's distortions of Israel's battle against the terrorist group Hamas. Early in the most recent ceasefire, the Los Angeles Times front page coverage suggested a standoff between two bad actors with innocent Palestinians paying the price. What did anyone gain, it asked, as Gazans are left bereft? This mystifying ignorance or bias of mainstream media concerning the real story was cited by Israel's ambassador to the United States, Ron Dermer. He was a guest of my colleague and guest host, Mark Larson.
Well, help us understand what's happened here over the weekend. If anybody watched the peephole to paradise known as television, ABC, NBC, CBS over the weekend, if anybody was just not paying attention and suddenly watched the news, they would think, well, here goes Israel. Look at them attacking these kids again. It was to the nth degree beyond what they've shown because of this UN facility that was hit. What really happened there? What do we need to know to get some context, Mr. Ambassador?
Well, the first thing you need to know is that Israel's under attack. And so when you're judging Israel's action, you have to judge it not by some standard of perfection that exists in some parallel universe, but you have to judge it based on how another country would react faced with similar threats. So you have to say, put it in an American context for American listeners. You've got over two-thirds of your country that multiple times a day has to run into bomb shelters. So over 200 million Americans are running into bomb shelters, and at a time you're fighting basically in contiguous territory against a terror organization that calls for your destruction, that works towards your destruction, calls to murder every single American, and you're trying to be very precise and pinpoint in targeting the terrorists and not hurting the population, but you're dealing with a terror organization that not only is firing rockets at your population, but is also using their own population as human shields by putting military command centers in hospitals, by using UN schools as weapons warehouses, and by having tunnels begin in mosque and go to the other side of Israel where their terrorists can come out and try to kill a lot of civilians. That's the reality that we're facing. Before you get to the facts of a specific case, you have to understand that context. And that's why I say very clearly, no military would act as Israel is acting now. No military would act with a restraint. Then I can tell you that Israel's dropping flyers and making phone calls and sending text messages. That's all true. But the remarkable thing is that Israel is acting the way that we're acting when our home front is under attack. In the last case that you have, to answer your question specifically, here we didn't target a UN school. We didn't even hit a UN school. And we certainly didn't use any shells. There were three terrorists who were on a motorcycle,
right,
and we used a precision strike to hit them. Now, why there are civilian casualties around, because there have been times in the past where we have done that without any casualties whatsoever, and it might have been that that was the case this time. We don't know. We have to actually first get the facts. We have to understand why there were civilian casualties, even though they were not targeted. But I think it's very important to never rush to judgment. First get all the facts, and I can tell you as somebody who's been in the war room with the prime minister, no military in history goes to such great lengths to put the civilians of the other side out of harm's way.
When we return.
Let me tell you what I think disproportionality is. It's not acting to defend your people and giving the terrorists the license to kill. I think that's disproportionate, and that's wrong.
Benjamin Netanyahu fights back when the townhall.com weekend journal continues in a moment. Stay with me.
My hands were steady, my eyes were clear and bright. My walk had purpose, my steps were quick and light, and I held firm to what I felt was right, like a rock.
Welcome back to the townhall.com weekend journal. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been in harm's way most of his life. He is the first prime minister to have been born in the state of Israel. This time around, he has served in office since 2009. A former commando with the IDF, Netanyahu served in the Six-Day War, the Yom Kippur War, as well as many separate combat missions. He's been wounded in action. But Netanyahu's combat experiences, when he knew who his enemies were, may have been less difficult than his present PR battles as a new generation of Israeli defense forces fight Hamas. With the UN threatening war crime charges against Israel, Prime Minister Netanyahu came to his nation's defense in a press conference this past week.
Indeed, Hamas has adopted a strategy that abuses and sacrifices Gaza's civilians. They use them as human shields, they endanger them, and deliberately increase the death toll. They fire their rockets at Israel from schools, from hospitals, from mosques, you've just seen that, from urban neighborhoods. Of course, nearly everyone says that they support Israel's right to defend itself, and we appreciate those who say this. But there are those who refuse to recognize to let Israel exercise that right. They would allow Hamas to attack with impunity because they say they're firing from schools or from mosques or from hospitals, and Israel should not take action against them.
that's obviously a mistake. It's a moral mistake. It's an operational mistake. Because that would validate and legitimize Hamas's use of human shields. And it would hand an enormous victory to terrorists everywhere and a devastating effect to the free societies that are fighting terrorism.
Prime Minister Simon Wilson for CNN. First of all, do you really feel that your actions, Israel's actions, were proportionate? And were you using the appropriate precision weapons, even if Hamas is using them as human shields?
So first of all, the answer to both your questions is yes. I think it was justified. I think it was proportional. And that doesn't in any way take away from the deep regret we have for the loss of a single civilian. We've gone to extraordinary lengths to avoid civilian casualties. Hamas has gone to extraordinary lengths to ensure that they have civilian casualties. Now, let's imagine your country attacked by 3,500 rockets. Your territory is infiltrated by death squads. What would you do? What would you demand that your government do to protect you and your family? You'd demand that, and you'd be right. Because security, protecting the people, is the first obligation of any government. But what if the rockets are fired from civilian areas, and the tunnels come from schools, from mosques, from private houses, where civilians live? Should you then not take action? Do the terrorists have immunity because of the fear that some civilians will unfortunately get hurt? Let me tell you what I think disproportionality is. It's not acting to defend your people and giving the terrorists the license to kill. I think that's disproportionate, and that's wrong.
Speaking of Hamas, the militant group that controls Gaza, their charter includes the complete annihilation of the state of Israel. One marvels at Hamas's ability to face the media with rabid anti-Semitism and, for the most part, get away with it. Recently, Wolf Blitzer of CNN faced down the official spokesperson of Hamas, Osama Hamdan, concerning one such rant. Michael Medved explained.
There are a couple of things you can mention and that you can say that are just going to get the world's attention by their very nature. And that happened with a gentleman, and I use the term advisedly, named Osama Hamdan, who is the official spokesperson for the Hamas terrorist group, the same group that Jimmy Carter wants us to honor. It turned out, spoke on Lebanese TV and in Lebanon, speaking on Al-Quds television. That's called Al-Quds means the holy, and that is the way that Muslims refer to the city of Jerusalem. And on Al-Quds TV, he made some remarks that Wolf Blitzer on CNN questioned him about last night. Here is the beginning of their interchange.
Well, I have to ask you one question because it's come to our attention. It's all over the Internet. Remarks that you made recently to Al-Quds TV, and I'm going to read it to you in the English translation. We had translators make sure the translation was accurate. I want you to explain what you said because it's very disturbing. You said, "We all remember how the Jews used to slaughter Christians in order to mix their blood with their holy matzahs. This is not a figment of the imagination or something taken from a film. It is a fact acknowledged by their own books and historical evidence. You believe that Jews would kill Christians to mix their blood to bake the holy matzahs on Passover? Is that your belief, Mr. Hamdan?"
Certainly, Wolf Blitzer doesn't know how quite to get a straight answer from the very curved and round Osama Hamdan.
"I have a Jewish friends who are supporting the Palestinian rights. We have rabbis who are supporting the Palestinian rights, and they are our friends.
I understand
and they are
that.
Against the new Nazis of this century, like Netanyahu and Figlin and some others who are senior officials in Israel."
Okay, and then one more with Wolf continuing trying to get him and giving him an opportunity to go ahead and say, no, of course, it's absurd. There is no blood libel. There is no historic or other or any or zero zip, not a zilch basis for believing, as has been charged since the 12th century, since the 1100s, that Jewish people actually murder Christians, particularly Christian children, to use their blood to bake in matzahs. This is a standard item of Palestinian propaganda, and it's one of the reasons that a lot of Israelis and Israel supporters actually think, well, you know, it's not going to be so easy to negotiate a peace settlement. If you're dealing with people who actually believe that, as Osama Hamdan obviously does, that you, for literally millennia, have been murdering people in order to drink their blood, that you're some kind of a vampire. If that is actually his belief, then maybe it's not going to be so easy to extend this truce into a meaningful peace that Jimmy Carter suggests. Speaking about some of the extremism that is around, some of the extremism applies to the world of double standards. There's a terrific column by Brett Stevens in the Wall Street Journal. And Brett Stevens, the title of the column is Palestine and Double Standards. And he begins with a description of some horrendous military actions that have taken place in the last couple of weeks. He says the military launched a major ground offensive, beginning what Army commanders said would be a house-to-house search for terrorist leaders and other militants. He says, since the war in Gaza began nearly a month ago, I've been bombarded with indignant letters, Brett Stevens writes, calling me a racist for my views and asking whether I'd like to live in Gaza. My answer to the second point is that I would no more want to live under Hamas than I would under any other fanatical dictatorship that starts gratuitous wars, uses civilians as human shields, punishes political opposition with death, and sends others to die while its leaders hide between hospital sheets. Seems to me to be beautifully expressed.
Coming up,
I believe in limited government, I believe in free market principles, and I believe in policies of personal responsibility, and I think that'll really differentiate me from the rest of the field.
The Ice Cream Man and his ascendancy when the Town Hall Weekend Journal continues in a moment. Welcome back to the TownHall.com Weekend Journal. I'm Hugh Hewitt. The governor's race in Arizona is heating up, and that's no pun intended. It is in the national spotlight, much the same way the current and often controversial governor, Jan Brewer. I have tracked closely with a frontrunner in this race, State Treasurer Doug Ducey. He's one of the founders of Cold Stone Creamery, the ice cream franchise that has become an international brand that was begun in Arizona. On the heels of a very welcome endorsement from former Governor Sarah Palin, I caught up with Doug, broadcasting live from Phoenix on my Wednesday show.
Well, they have thrown what they call dark money, $1 million in independent expenditures negative at the ice cream man. I can't believe they're trying to make ice cream a bad thing. But to that, you've responded with Ted Cruz, Mike Lee, Scott Walker, Mike Pence, Trent Franks, John Kyle, Sheriff Joe Arpaio, today Sarah Palin. You got my buddy John, Dennis Prager, you got me. All the conservatives are kind of rallying around you. So this makes it the conservative versus the liberal in Scott Smith. Do you like those odds?
Well, when Senator L. Melvin stepped out of the race and endorsed us, he used the words of William F. Buckley. And Senator Melvin said, Doug Ducey is the most electable conservative in the race. And I'll embrace that because that is what I am. I believe in limited government. I believe in free market principles. And I believe in policies of personal responsibility. And I think that'll really differentiate me from the rest of the field.
You also have Joe Arpaio, who's...
Yes.
Mr. Border, the toughest sheriff. I haven't talked to Joe in a long, long time. He's coming on in hour three of the program today. Big, big help to you. And he obviously, everyone went down and knocked on his door, and he picked you. Why do you think he picked you?
Well, I think he picked me because I've been knocking on his door before I was running for office. I built a relationship with Sheriff Joe. I've gone to him and asked questions and not just talk to him. You know, he's been in law enforcement his entire life before he ran for sheriff here in Arizona, and he's got a lot of good ideas, not only on border security, but how you build relationships and work both sides of the border. And I picked his brain, and I wooed his endorsement, and he said I had the most reasonable plan that was workable around border security. And I spent all yesterday down at our southern border in Cochise County. I learned a lot and saw a lot, and I'm very proud to have Sheriff Joe endorsing our campaign.
What do you say to the independents? Because independents can vote in the Arizona primary. There are a couple of kinds of independents out there that people can't make up their mind, and there are those who think the Republican Party went soft. You got to talk to both of them, right?
Well, I say to independents, vote for Doug Ducey. I think things like kickstarting our economy are not a partisan issue, and how we do that without helping out the crony guys and the fat cats, but allowing the small businessman to grow and making Arizona the best state in the nation in which to do business, that's something that will appeal to independents. I think the independents that are frustrated with what's going on in our K-12 education system, I'd ask them to vote for Doug Ducey because my ideas are based on outcomes and results. And I want to get Arizona out from underneath the thumb of our federal government and Barack Obama. I want to be the most innovative, inventive governor with new ideas to lead Arizona forward. I'm appealing to independents just like I'm appealing to conservatives.
Now, the reason I originally signed up with you, and I was telling my friend Steve at lunch today, I flew back from London yesterday. And I was thinking about why. I knew I was coming over today, and the fetching Mrs. Hewitt said, why are you going over there? And I actually said, this was after I took an Ambien, but I don't think it was before it kicked in, because of education reform. And Yes. This is, you're big on this. I'm on the Great Hearts Board here in Arizona. It is the most progressive education reform state in the union. You're totally committed to this. But your opponent, Scott Smith, is for Common Core. I honestly don't think there's a conservative in the country who's for Common Core anymore.
I can't speak on behalf of my opponent in his position, but I love what Great Hearts is doing. I love what Basis is doing. I love what our K-12s are doing that are actually getting results and positive outcomes. And it's the same principles of great teachers in the classroom and committed principals who will make personnel decisions. And then we need to have some flexibility around these funding formulas. I think if my numbers are right, Hugh, the Great Heart System has a 12,000 kid wait list.
Yeah, so that's true.
Plus, here in Arizona. So mom and dad have made a decision that this is the place that we would like our child to go to school, and we've got no flexibility in this funding to clear the wait list. And the same with the Basis schools and other schools that are excelling around the state.
Now, you've got Council for Arizona Policy, Kathy Herod, in her individual capacity, is supporting you. You have Trent Franks, Mr. Right to Life, supporting you. You've got basically, you're Roman Catholic, but you have the evangelical community. A lot of LDS people are supporting you, a lot of people non-denominational. But the culture wars are not really what you're running about. You're really running about the economy.
I'm running on the economy, but I'm very proud of the coalition I have. I'm very proud to be endorsed by Arizona Right to Life. But what animates the campaign, what I think the opportunity is for somebody who was a businessman in the private sector for his entire adult life before he became state treasurer, is to kickstart this economy and to bring those principles to our education system so that we focus on the kids in the classroom who are the real customers in this equation, and understand that we need to embrace, incent, and honor our teachers. Because the biggest difference between what happens inside a classroom is a teacher. It's what Great Hearts has right. It's what every excelling school in the state has right. There should be no excuses. This should be a relentless pursuit of results inside our classroom. And I believe Arizona can both lead economically and on the education side of the equation. And that's what a Ducey campaign is about.
Coming up.
It was your president, Teddy Roosevelt, who said that the secret of foreign policy was to speak softly and carry a big stick. And I'm afraid that the Obama administration's got this the wrong way around, and they express grave concern and draw red lines, but they carry a very small stick.
When the townhall.com weekend journal continues in a moment. Welcome back to the townhall.com weekend journal. I'm Hugh Hewitt. So what do we make of the violence that has hit Ukraine? Will it spread? Many observers think it's more than an isolated dust-up. Plus, there are no signs of an easing of tensions there. Russian President Vladimir Putin continues making bold, even audacious moves, intimidating the increasingly timid Western leadership, even invoking sanctions against us. Edward Lucas, a British commentator and foreign policy expert, thinks there is plenty to worry about, potentially the entire world order. Lucas was a guest of Michael Medved's, talking about his latest book, The New Cold War.
Your book was attacked, at least the idea of your book, though not by name, in a piece in USA Today by Bob Beckel and Cal Thomas. And the headline is Cold War II? Yet. And Bob Beckel writes, Time magazine's recent cover suggesting the possibility of a Cold War II between the U.S. and Russia is irresponsible at best and uninformed at worst. Ouch. And he says, Time has taken the incident of the shooting down of the airliner as the principal reason that we are moving toward a new Cold War between the United States, its allies, and Russia. Nothing could be further from the truth. And then he says, When the wall fell, communism was exposed as a failure. Today, the expansion of NATO is extended to the Russian border. The idea that these countries, among them Poland, Hungary, and the Baltic states, could ever return to Russian influence is absurd. Is Bob Beckel right?
No, he's completely wrong, and it's very astonishing and distressing to me to see that people can get there. I think you have to be a foreign policy expert to get things as wrong as that. So for a start, I think there's a real problem with Russian influence in particularly the Baltic states and other places in Eastern Europe. You know, they're buying politicians, they're buying political parties, they buy media. There's real problems with even the military security of these countries. So it is actually a problem, whatever Mr. Beckel and his friends say. I think, secondly, just because it's not the same as the old Cold War doesn't mean it's not a problem. And clearly there's no more communism. Putin is actually kind of the worst sort of capitalist. There's an old Russian joke that everything they said about communism was wrong, but everything they said about capitalism was true. And so this kind of authoritarian crony capitalism that Mr. Putin and his friends practice is really ghastly, and it's certainly not communism. But it is a threat. It's not particularly a global threat to the United States in the way that Soviet communism was. But my goodness, it's a threat inside Europe, as we're seeing right now. It's a threat to Russia's neighbors, as we're seeing right now. And in a way, it's a threat to the whole world order, because America is not on the front foot at the moment. It's under the Obama presidency, we've seen the pivot away from allies and a more introverted foreign policy. And I think all sorts of countries, Russia among them, are taking advantage of that.
One of the things that was very striking during the Cold War, and particularly its last stages, is you had a number of Western leaders, including, of course, President Reagan and Prime Minister Thatcher, to some extent, even Chancellor Kohl in Germany, who were speaking out against the evil empire. President Obama is not going to be speaking out against much of anything except the evil empire of Republicans that he sees as the greatest threat to humanity. But given the silence and quiescence of President Obama, is there another voice that could raise the alarm and actually give expression to some of the dangers that you elucidate in your book?
I think you're right that America is, to use the Obama administration's phrase, leading from behind. It's leading from very far behind in some ways. And in a way, I think that's right, that ultimately, as a European, I have huge respect and gratitude for what America did for us in two world wars and the Cold War. But ultimately, the European Union is bigger than America. It's got more people, bigger GDP. And we should be able to sort out these security problems mainly on our own. And we're very grateful for American support and some things that only America can do. But I do think there's something a bit odd about having these enormous economies like Britain, France, Germany, Italy, and so on, all unable to deal with what is ultimately a regional security problem. And so I very much hope that Europe is getting its act together now. And I think America, particularly the Congress, has done a very good job in pushing through sanctions on some of Putin's real cronies, the so-called Magnitsky Act of visa bans and asset freezes, and going after some of the inner circle. I think that's great, and I'm very grateful to Congress for that. But in Europe, we should be able to sort this out. And I'm glad to see that Mrs. Merkel in Germany, Mr. Cameron here, my own Prime Minister, are beginning to talk much more toughly about what's going on, because ultimately we are in the front line. We are the people who are most in danger from this sort of Putin revanchism and attempt to tear up the rules of the European security order.
Well, one of the things, and this is something where I honestly do not know the answer, but just a few months ago, really, the administration had drawn a red line in the sand and had said that we were going to take strong action to respond to the use of chemical weapons by the murderous Assad regime in Syria. I mean, murderous to the extent of 175,000 minimum dead civilians. So, okay, we didn't do anything. We outsourced that to Vladimir Putin, and he was going to take responsibility for working with his friends in Syria in getting rid of the chemical weapons. I do not know the answer to this. How is that all going?
Well, I think that it was your president, Teddy Roosevelt, who said that the secret of foreign policy was to speak softly and carry a big stick. And I'm afraid that the Obama administration's got this the wrong way round, and they express grave concern and draw red lines and so on, but they don't carry, they carry a very small stick. And I think that we've we had a chance in Syria to have a toppling of the Assad regime with people who basically believed in our values. We didn't help them, and now they've been pushed out of the way by people who hate us. And that's a terrible outcome. On the chemical weapons, yes, the Russian brokered deal has led to the destruction of a lot of the Assad regime's chemical weapons, and that's good. But they've still got more. We're still seeing isolated instances of those being used against the rebels. So I think it'd be very hard to look at the Syrian history of the last 18 months or 2 years and say this was a triumph. And it's actually exactly what Putin wants. He likes to say that it's a choice between me and Al-Qaeda. Which do you want? And then, of course, we choose him. And he's, yeah, and that's what he's done in Syria. He's made it into a choice between the Assad regime, which is basically a sort of Putinist-type regime, or these crazy people who want to just, you know, murder and kill and destroy everything the West stands for. And so it's a great outcome from his point of view and a very bad one from ours.
Coming up, David Gallerner on this most dangerous moment in America.
I think any NATO country would be crazy to believe that Obama will honor those treaties. His policy is to honor nothing.
In our final segment of the townhall.com weekend journal. Welcome back to the townhall.com weekend journal. I'm Hugh Hewitt. There's a growing consensus among people who read and pay attention to developments at home and abroad, people who care about America, that this is a critical moment in our nation's history. David Gallerner has seen America's dark side. In 1993, he was nearly killed by a mail bomb from the Unabomber Ted Kaczynski. But gratefully, he survived and is writing and speaking boldly about important things and has been since then. A frequent guest on Bill Bennett's show, David's most recent visit, saw him looking at our country's lack of resolve.
Britain was leading from behind. I just want to pause on that. Go ahead to repeat that last sentence because I was talking.
Historians are agreed that if the Nazi regime had believed the English when they said we draw the line here, there's a red line in the sand, right? You know, we will declare war if you invade Poland. But after all, they had stood behind Danzig. They had stood behind the territorial integrity of Czechoslovakia. They had stood behind the independence of Austria, which was part of the Treaty agreements, and all that was meaningless and was torn up strictly for the drop of a hat for political reasons. And we saw all the polls. You know, at the time, British leaders said, "Well, there's no appetite for war among the public," and we hear this among Democratic commentators as if this were an excuse for the complete zero of leadership coming out of the administration.
The public opinion polls of Obama are pretty low. Still, I don't know why 42% approve. But he gets higher ratings for foreign policy because it's not our business. This Hamas.
Well, the American public need to have a case made to them. I mean, they won't write a blank check. They need to hear. Some of that 42%, we're reaching a point. There was a sequester, as we know, which was eventually replaced, but had the effect of causing something to happen. If we don't have a sequester of federal government hiring soon and a rollback, we will no longer be in a position to do that, and the private sector will lose control of this country. I don't want to be an alarmist. We haven't now, but unless we think about taking action, we are supporting a minority of the population that is part of the government establishment. And why we allow that to happen, why we allow it to grow relentlessly, why we allow bonuses and salaries in that segment to grow relentlessly, and we allow it to steal workers from the private sector, is this the way we want to run the country? We have lost control of our borders, of course. We've also lost control of our federal workforce. What have we not lost control of?
Okay. So you, like I, share the notion that there's no guarantee if a NATO country were invaded by Russia or, you know,
intruded on. I think any NATO country would be crazy to believe that Obama will honor those treaties. His policy is to honor nothing.
Thank you for joining us for the townhall.com Weekend Journal. Tell a friend and sign up for a podcast of our program at townhallweekendjournal.com. And be sure to follow us now on Twitter at Town Hall Review. And let me know briefly, you can follow my own reporting each and every day at townhall.com. Look for the tip sheet. For executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Greg Hengler and Dwayne Patterson, I'm Hugh Hewitt. Join us again next week for another edition of the Town Hall Weekend Journal, the weekend news program from a perspective you can trust.